Welcome to the Anaheim Calling Podcast, Tuesday night edition. It's been a long, long time since we last spoke, all the way back to last night where the Ducks took on the New Jersey Devils. Tonight, taking on the New York Rangers at Madison Square. It's always slightly more interesting when you're playing in the Big Apple, I guess, at MSG. The Ducks lose this one 4-1 in what was kind of an interesting game where you could argue maybe they deserved a slightly better fate. Joined tonight by Jake Rudolph, regular on the show. Really doesn't need an introduction anymore, but Anaheim Calling staff writer extraordinaire.
What's up?
So, Jake, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, as always. Tonight's game was... It was interesting because they didn't necessarily play bad, didn't necessarily play great with breakdowns, but I think what it comes down to is Henrik Lundqvist had a Henrik Lundqvist game.
Yeah, Henrik Lundqvist played extremely well. I mean, you look at the final shots, the Ducks ended up with 60 shot attempts to the Rangers 45. And, you know, there's a little maybe context needed there. But even so, the Ducks got the bulk of their offense or their shot attempts in the second period, not when they were down by a crazy amount of goals. So we're going to get into it really quickly here, just recap the goals for the night. I'm going to ask you a question, Jake, and you have to be honest here. Did you know who Paul Carey was before tonight?
No. You don't really have to pry me, to be honest. I'm fine with being honest.
And that's why we love you, Jake. But yeah, that's why you're the crowd favorite. So I didn't know who Paul Carey was either, and I like to think that I pay attention to hockey at least more than the average person. But I guess I'm not enough of a fan. Also, before we get into the goals, wanted to bring up maybe the story of the night, since I don't think the game was that interesting. Brandon Montour scratched before the game. That was I know Montour's had a couple of maybe more difficult games. Also, yet again, throw this into the bucket of coaching decisions directly correlate with PDO. Montour hasn't really been scoring either as of late. So, yeah, bit of an odd one there.
Yeah, I mean, I usually try to make some sort of joke in self-deprecating humor way. Couldn't even figure out one. This was just that bad. It was that bad of a decision. So, yeah, I got nothing. I mean, I was listening to the radio broadcast, and they were kind of bringing up, they were asked a question about it during their Ducks Q segment in the intermission. And they had brought up that they think it was just kind of to put him up in the press box so he could watch a game and that they expect him to be back in the lineup. My issue with kind of that thought process is, yeah, maybe it could help him, maybe it won't. But this guy's been like a really, really important piece to the team. And now you're taking him out of the lineup and it significantly worsens the team. You're not icing your best lineup if you are putting him in the press box. And it's a problem. And it's that old school mentality of you're young, you need to kind of take a seat and look at what's going on instead of letting him kind of work through his issues. And this is a guy that's been a really important piece. And the power play, I think, suffered tonight. And it was because they didn't have him.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough with Brandon Montour because I think, he's going to have maybe his games where he doesn't look as good. I mean, he was on the ice for two goals against New Jersey or two goals against at even strength. And yeah, you know, like that's coaches will look at that and probably not like it as much. And, you know, you look at his numbers on the season and they're not particularly great, at least, you know, like possession wise. But then to be fair, no one on the Ducks is doing well in that category either. And I don't think the coaching staff looks at that to make decisions anyway. So you really boil it down to, you know, he probably was just on the ice for two goals yesterday and hasn't scored in a while. And they were like, you know, let's teach him a lesson here. Because clearly, you know, Brandon Montour is going to learn something from being scratched tonight. And meanwhile, guys like Bieksa and Beauchemin, who can kind of just do whatever they want, and they're gonna stay in the lineup no matter what. And I don't want to dump on those guys. It's just it's interesting how the meritocracy works. Clearly, Carlisle being an old school coach, Montour being a younger defenseman, he's at risk for being scratched. Andy Walensky slotting in to take his place. A guy that I don't really have any strong opinions about him since I've seen him. I do think that he has a good first pass, and he's kind of cerebral in the offensive zone, has a decent shot. I think he's got a little more offensive upside than Jacob Megna. But yeah, Walensky slots in to take Montour's place, and you ask yourself, well, maybe is this a vote of confidence for Walensky that he's, you know, maybe he's usurping Brandon Montour in the lineup? I don't think that's the case at all. I think that Brandon Montour's job is safe, and this was just an opportunity for them to kind of dig into him and also give Walensky a shot. Do you think that there's any part of this that speaks to the way Walensky's played?
I don't really think so. I don't think he's been a replacement level player. I think like he's produced some good plays. He's had some good assists. He had a point in each of his first two games, which was impressive. And I think he seems like he'd be a really good bottom pairing guy. I mean, I'd basically play anyone over Bieksa, but he's held his own. He's not an impact player, though, and that's kind of, I think, the difference between him and a Brandon Montour. Brandon Montour, when he's on the ice, he can make something happen. Whether he'll get burned sometimes, sure, but that's going to happen with what he brings and the type of offense he can create. On Brandon Montour, really quickly, SJ Hawking brought up that Montour hasn't been scoring lately because he's on a second power play. And I think that's a decent point, but I don't think I'm curious how many of his points originally were on the power play. I think a fair amount. But that second unit also has started to get some more talent on with everyone coming back, so he should still be able to take advantage on that second unit. I think we're just kind of seeing a bit of a lull. All guys will go through good stretches and bad stretches until in terms of scoring. Scoring is very, very streaky in this league. You can see, I mean, I think Nikita Kucherov started the season with 14 straight, 14 points in 14 games or something along those lines, or more than that even. But he even went cold for a little bit. Guys get hot, guys get cold. And I just think sitting him is just such a big mistake. And, I mean, they lost tonight, so yeah.
Well, it's interesting because I think that SJ Hawking, I actually kind of buy into that a little bit. Not because, like you said, it's not that he was necessarily feasting on the power play, but to me, that's kind of his best shot at picking up points. You know, started off the season real hot. I mean, he has 16 points in 33 games as a defenseman on an offensively challenged team. That's pretty impressive. But yeah, I just think that not only have they been playing on the second unit, they're not even using him, or they haven't really been using him as much in that shooting spot on the left side, you know, as a right-handed shot. So yeah, he's not scoring, and maybe it's not necessarily directly correlated to the fact he's not on the power play, but I think that he has like less opportunities to produce now, and you know, it's just a little tougher for him. So yeah, I think that you look at it as a whole, and it feels like maybe they were just trying to, I don't know what. We don't need to explain this sometimes.
It's pretty simple. It's Carlisle being Carlisle. It's that old school mentality. We all know why it happens. It's hard to really come up with some justification for it other than the reasoning Carlisle gives. And I think that's the frustrating thing, is that we know why it happened, but none of us agree with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just old school, you know, hockey think. And it's funny because, like, when I tweeted, when the news was reported astutely by Eric Stevens about the potential for Montour being scratched, I tweeted, you know, like, man, I didn't see this one coming. Like, I mean, you kind of look at his stats, maybe you get a sense for why. And then the first comment on my tweet, the first reply was just Carlisle'd. And I felt like that was pretty accurate. Shout out to Sean Regan for that. That cracked me up there. Yeah. But so getting into tonight's goals, we're just going to – oh, yeah, so Paul Carey, we tried to explain we talked about him a little bit earlier. But this was like what you said, you know, earlier, where a lot of tonight was breakdowns. Certainly this first goal was no different, kind of set the tone for some of the goals that Anaheim was going to allow. Nick Holden, of all people, makes a beautiful bank pass up the ice to David Desharnais, who brings him to the zone, had a couple assists tonight. And dishes it over to Paul Carey in the slot. And, you know, Carey is so unbelievably open on that play that you wonder, well, how did that happen? And in the neutral zone, Carey basically just outpaced, basically just beat Ryan Getzlaf to the net. and Getzlaff maybe was puck watching a little bit, but lost carry, gave him that lane. And I think part of it was Nick Holden's quick pass up the ice, maybe threw the Ducks off guard a little bit or caught Getzlaff flat-footed. But either way, he's left with his man screaming to the net, completely uncovered. And then Beauchemin, who's kind of the last guy who could have maybe rotated over, is just watching the puck, assuming that his center is going to get back. So kind of a lack of communication, lack of awareness, and, you know, lack of – I mean, Getzlaff's never going to be the strongest defensive guy without the puck, but not really a good look for him there.
Yeah, and, I mean, I watched that play a couple times because, I mean, I think the easy thing to look at is obviously Getzlaff should be back there. But it's a weird play because Nick Ritchie drops low there. And you'd really like to see if you have that forward drop low and he's covering the man with the puck. I believe it was Desarnais with the puck. You'd like to see either kind of Ritchie shift over or Fowler shift over to cover the guy Beauchemin on and Beauchemin cover that back post. It's just there was a complete breakdown of communication. And there was a – I mean, yes, Getzlaff, that's the easy solution. He gets back, covers that guy. But there's two or three other ways that that play is covered perfectly well and nothing bad happens. And so – yeah, it was just a breakdown on all sorts of levels.
Yeah, no, I mean, like any play in hockey, it's kind of like a chain reaction. One missed coverage leads to another. And mm-hmm. Yeah, so definitely agree with you there. Second period, moving on here, 38 seconds into the period, Kevin Hayes puts the Rangers up 2-0. This one, really a weird play because looks kind of simple. But once again, you have a guy who's just left all alone on that left side, Zuccarello with a nice pass to him. And to your point about Nick Ritchie, so this was kind of a weird situation because I believe it was JT Miller comes off the ice really slowly, and the puck is already in the Anaheim zone. JT Miller for the Rangers or whoever it was comes off the ice real slowly, looks hurt. And by the time he gets all the way off and Hayes gets on, everyone has kind of forgotten about JT Miller or whoever it was that came off. So Raquel is just completely watching the strong side, the side of the puck, not really considering the fact that a guy might just be jumping on. And then Nick Ritchie, I believe that might have been his man. It was either Raquel's or Ritchie's, but Ritchie was the guy covering the guy who came off below the goal line, and then his man comes off, and he just kind of forgets about him, forgets about that entire scenario. And then Hayes is allowed to come on basically untouched and just wires it home. Nice feed from Zuccarello. So
yeah, I think,
really bizarre play there.
Yeah, if that's the play I'm thinking of, which I'm pretty sure it is, that's on Raquel. I mean, he's just puck-watching. Yeah, he doesn't see it.
He has to consider it's like, you know, Bill Nye the Science Guy, consider this or consider the following.
Throwing
it's like
it back.
The guy coming off is going to have a replacement at some point. So, yeah, anyway, first Bill Nye reference on the show.
Mm-hmm. Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Yeah, big shout out. And so the Rangers eventually make it 3-0 going into or to end that second period. Paul Carey, once again, never heard about him until tonight, and I'm never going to forget him. Another kind of just bizarre goal, you know, on the rush again. Jimmy Vesey hits David Desarnais once again across the ice. Really nice feed. Desarnais takes it down the left side, just throws on the brakes. And passes it to, once again, a wide-open Paul Carey in the slot. And you're wondering, how did this happen? And kind of a weird, awkward change in the Anaheim from the Anaheim bench. Shaw loses his man in the neutral zone. Derek Grant goes for a hit, basically, after the puck is already dumped. And, you know, maybe if he doesn't go for the hit there, something might be different. He's allowed to maybe maintain that gap a little bit and discourage the entry there, but just a bizarre play there. And I don't, it's kind of one of those where it illustrates once again, and this isn't obviously the strongest illustration, but that this Ducks team loses its focus quite often. It just feels like these things are avoidable. I don't know.
I mean, it's the fourth line for you right there.
But fourth lines are supposed to like not do this. Like this
yeah,
is like,
but
you put a fourth line out there and it's supposed to be reliable.
Yeah.
At least that's the theory.
Well, that's the theory with grinders, with guys like Chris Wagner and Logan Shaw and Derek Grant. But we've started to see, and I mean, this is something I noticed when I have been putting together my weekly rankings over the last couple weeks. Chris Wagner is really not that good. He's been getting shelled a lot lately. And it's something that's really surprising to me because I had kind of come into the season thinking he would be a really solid fourth line center. And granted, got to add the bit of a qualifier that he's been in an elevated role where he shouldn't be. But even last week when he was back in his role, he was one of the absolute worst Ducks on the ice in terms of shot attempts, in terms of scoring chances, everything you want to see. And he's doing it in limited minutes. I'm pretty sure I'm remembering correctly from this past week's rankings, but I think he was fifth worst on the team in expected goals against, and he did it in 10 less 5-on-5 minutes than any other guy that's ahead of him. Mm. And it's just insane. I mean, sorry to bring back to this old wound, but the fact that Kevin Waugh isn't good enough to play on that line, like, it's a joke that's even a thought. And so, I mean, yeah, they're not good. Let's just put it as that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that individually, the Ducks fourth line, some of them have. I think Logan Schaub, for example, is a better skater than maybe we give him credit for. I think that he's gotten a little better in some areas of the game, stick handling wise. I think Chris Wagner is a quick player who can, you know, kind of lay the body out there. But for whatever reason, when those guys are out there together, it just does not work. And to me, like, that's kind of coaching, because your fourth line, like, they play exactly how a coach wants them to play. There is no creativity. They're just going by the book. That's their ticket to stay in the lineup. So anyway, fourth line, not really a strength for the Ducks right now. Moving on to the third period, Andre Kasha, seventh goal of the year for him. Getzlaf with a really nice little kind of just slip backhand pass at the blue line there to break open the play. So yeah, just a nice play by Kasha, snaps it 5-hole on Lundqvist. At that point, the Ducks are down 3-1, and you think to yourself, well, maybe now that it's a two-goal game, maybe they'll come back, and they certainly, it seemed like they could do that, but Henrik Lundqvist shuts the door. The Rangers eventually make it 4-1, and at that point, kind of a weird play. It appeared that Raquel might have saved it on the goal line. John Gibson actually makes a real nice glove save on a Michael Grabner breakaway there, I guess semi-breakaway. But the referees eventually judge it a good goal. Yep. That makes it 4-1. And at that point, game's pretty much over.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, there's not a whole lot to say. The Ducks were, at that point, kind of freewheeling, trying to get something going. One thing I do want to say about this game, seeing as we've talked about kind of all the goals against and kind of broken it down into all these plays, hockey's a weird, weird game where, I mean, you could be playing well and just one or two breakdowns and the other team takes advantage of it. I feel like that's kind of this game. I know I said it kind of off the top, but this was a really good game by the Ducks, and I think it's the best game they've played if we're isolating just overall performance for 60 minutes. This is one of the best games they've played in a while, and it'd be nice if they can kind of keep this up. I'm looking at Korsica's website, and I think it looks like everyone except for 1, 2, 3, 4 guys were below 50% in terms of Corsi 4. And those four were Andy Walensky, Francois Beaujolais, Nick Ritchie, and Raquel.
There you go.
Yeah.
The usual suspects.
Yeah. So, it's frustrating. It's one of those things. Expected goals, the Ducks ended up on the bottom end of, so maybe the chances against weren't the best in the world, but it wasn't like they were that outclassed. I think the 4-1 final score is a little bit unfair for how the actual game went, and so I think there are positives that can be taken.
Yeah, I think that, especially that second period, I mean, you just look at the numbers, 26 shot attempts to 12, you would think, I mean, 14 scoring chances to 8, really a good period. But then, you know, you go into that third period where you would think this is the period where, you know, the Ducks really just lay it all out there. And then, you know, they actually get outchanced. High danger chance 8-3. Yeah. So that's kind of odd. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, like, it's just, you would think that would be the period where they kind of make the push.
Yeah, but they're also on the back end of back-to-backs.
So. Yeah, that's for sure a factor.
There's that to factor in. So I think it's frustrating. You don't like losing both games of a back-to-back, and especially not getting any points out of the two games. Kind of puts them in a pretty bad spot. But I think there are some positives. You want to start jumping into questions? I feel like that's kind of...
Yes. So just to kind of put a bow in this thing. So now with that loss, the Ducks are, let's see here, they remain only 2 points out of the third spot in the Pacific Division. Obviously, though, the Sharks holding a pretty sizable advantage there in terms of games played, 32 to Anaheim's 35. So the games in hand, they're definitely a factor. The Ducks now 3 points out of the final wild card spot, and are basically there's a 3-point spread between them, three other teams battling for that spot. So not a huge setback tonight for the Ducks, but this is just, you know, this is giving the other teams opportunities to get ahead of them. So it's not great. And I believe it was, let's see here, who was it? Yeah, DuckArs93 was asking, what is the Ducks' playoff percentage after tonight's game? How does it need to get, in your opinion, before management considers a coaching change? So that's a good segue into what we're going to talk about next. Mm-hmm. But as far as the probability of them making the playoffs, as things stand right now, so Money Puck, who generally is a lot less favorable towards the Ducks' playoff chances, has them at 19%, 19.41% to make the playoffs right now after tonight's game. And then before tonight's game, the Athletic had the Ducks at 41% to make the playoffs. So if you kind of average those out, I guess, the Ducks maybe are at like a 30% chance or whatever. So it's not out of reach, but it's not looking the best either, I guess.
Yeah, and one note I want to add on kind of that is, a lot of people are kind of saying, and I feel like we've kind of said it also, that, oh, well, they're injured, they've kind of made it through the storm, and kind of now that everyone's back, it's going to be good. And there's no guarantees. There are no guarantees that even with this deep of a lineup that they're going to make a push. The Ducks are really struggling at limiting shot attempts against, limiting expected goals against, limiting chances against. And they've been doing this with a full defensive lineup for a while now, and it's something that's very concerning to me moving forward, that if they keep bleeding shots, even getting Getzlaff and Kessler back isn't going to help it that much. We're starting to see, I believe it was Sean Tierney, Charting Hockey's tweeted out. He puts out a lot of really, really good charts. And one of the ones he kind of puts out is just kind of the Corsi 4 per 60 and Corsi against per 60 as your X and Y axis. One quadrant is going to be fun. One quadrant is bad. One quadrant is good. One quadrant's dull is the other one. And so the Ducks for a while have been kind of trending towards that bad area, which means you're giving up a lot of shots against and you're not getting a lot of shots for. And so in the last little bit, we're starting to see a trend where the Ducks are starting to get some more shots for, which makes sense when you're getting guys like Getzlaff back and Raquel's kind of getting healthier, Kasha's back. These guys are going to drive play the other way and get some more shots for, but the shot attempts against are still bad. They're not worse in the league anymore. I think Arizona has taken that title from them, but you don't exactly want to be in the same boat as an Arizona Coyotes team that has 19 points on the season.
Yeah, I mean that's what this comes down to, right? Now, you know, like we've been saying since the beginning, injuries are very convenient, you know, in terms of evaluating what's going on the ice, especially if you're the coach, because like, well, I don't have my guys. But to me, it says a lot of different things about Randy Carlyle. And I think one of them, since now I guess we're going to jump ahead here, with the coaching change question, it sounds like, according to Jake, there was some consternation on Ducks Twitter after the game about Carlyle's job security. And it's like you said, first off, going back, no guarantees when they get healthy. But looking at Carlisle's job security now, I don't think it's really in danger. But in terms of, I mean, to go back to the original question, how bad does it need to get before management considers a coaching change? Honestly, in my opinion, and this will be kind of like the start of this larger conversation, I think the Ducks would have to be incredibly, like you said, Arizona bad to fire Randy Carlisle. And even then, I don't think it's going to happen because I see them not either being able or wanting to blame him, and them also just not wanting to fire a guy and having to pay him to not coach, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think Carlisle is basically safe for this season. I think, as we talked about with kind of injuries as being a kind of good or a crux for this team, I think that he's going to have that to fall back on, being like, oh, well, we were so injured. I didn't have the full slate of guys. That's why we've been so bad. I think the only way he'd be fired midseason is if the Ducks are really out of the playoff picture come, like, the trade deadline and are really, really bad and trending for that number one overall pick spot. That's the only way I would really kind of see it happening. I mean, we can fan the flames and say they're going to fire Carlisle tomorrow. I'd love that. I'd love to bring in someone else, have some fun hockey again. But I just don't see it happening. I think he's clearly Bob Murray's guy. He's Bob Murray's guy enough where Bob Murray fired him and then brought him back within one coach.
Like, and he just saw what happened in Toronto.
Like, there's one coach between them, and they brought him back. Like, it's not like it was 10 years later and they brought him back or something, like kind of with Hitchcock going back to Dallas. This is like 4 years. This isn't a big span. This is him, like, oh, I'm getting just so frustrated again thinking about this that they would even think about bringing him back. So, yeah, I kind of want to get your opinion on this. If, let's say, hypothetically, the greatest thing happens and he's fired, who would you like to see come in out of kind of the coaches available?
Well, I'd have to think. I don't even know who's available right now.
I mean, have one answer for you.
Bob Hartley? Is it, like, I'm trying to think.
He was in the running for the job. I can't remember
who he interviewed. Yeah. You'd have to throw some names at me first because I don't know. I can't think of the free agent list right now.
Well, I mean, the name that comes to the front of my mind is some guy already in the organization in Dallas.
Oh, Orleans. Yeah. But do you really see that happening, though?
I mean, can I dream? I mean, this is all hypothetical, so I can dream right now. I would love to see Dallas Eakins given a shot. I think he got the bad end of the straw, or this, whatever the saying is in Edmonton. That team was just in such a bad spot, and he had to be the fall guy for them. I think he's done great work down in San Diego. I feel like it's once a year he's on the TSN Hockey Analytics podcast, and whenever you hear him talk about the game, it's so nice to hear someone within the game have that perspective. And he constantly brings up the fact that, I mean, you and I are both very analytics friendly, as everyone kind of listening probably understands. We use it a lot. We believe in it. It's something that we both believe have a lot of value. And so being on that podcast, Dallas Eakins, he doesn't shut it down like a lot of guys do. He kind of says, yes, it's a tool. It's something that I can use. It's something that definitely has value. And I think we both, to varying degrees, don't believe that heart or grit matters that much, but it does play a part. And especially for a guy behind the bench, he has to be able to read his guys. And he said, he's like, I value Corsi and all those advanced stats just as much as I do heart and grit. It matters. It's something that I look at. Obviously the availability of those stats isn't as great in the AHL, but he's like, it matters. And any tool that I can use to my advantage is something that I should be doing. I would not be doing my job if I wasn't. And to me, that's the exact type of mentality you want. And I don't feel like I've ever gotten that kind of vibe from Carlisle. It's always kind of old school, where it's what he thinks is the best is the way it should be going. It's never trying to learn on the job.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, I was actually listening to Craig Cousins' podcast over at The Athletic last night, and he had on, the name is escaping me, but the former assistant GM of the Minnesota Wild when they were first brought into the league as an expansion team. And it was a very interesting interview because the guest was, he talked about how his path to the NHL as an assistant GM was that he was a lawyer at one of the biggest law firms in the country that also the NHL hires for lockouts. And he was also a former college player. And so I was like, okay, like a law guy as a GM or as a assistant GM, like this is going to be, he's going to be the like smart GM type, like, you know, very sharp and or whatever. But by smart, I just mean more analytical. And then he got into it. And I was like, oh my God, the amount of value that you wouldn't believe how much value people like him, and he's been on the inside and he's sharing everything, how much they value in terms of character and chemistry. I mean, he would literally take the trainers out to dinner just to ask them, like, you know, like who's liked in the room? Who do people get annoyed by? Like stuff like that. And what he was saying in the interview was that those kind of tactics of really knowing the chemistry of the room, that was prevalent in, like, that was from Scotty Bowman, who is looked at as the godfather of NHL coaching and certainly is. But that was something that coaches felt like they had to do. And I don't think that sentiment has really changed. Not so much the policing of the players, but more so just this idea that locker room chemistry really, really matters. And so spinning it forward to this conversation, you know, Bob Murray is an old school guy. He is not the type to be, I mean, he's got some new school sprinkled in, but I don't see him as that guy who's going to, you know, hire a Kyle Dubas or hire a John Chayka or promote a Dallas Eakins. Maybe Dallas is a better chance than most considering his NHL past. But if the Ducks bring in a new coach, I mean, you look at Dave Tippett, he's available. And Dave Tippett.
Way to bring me down.
I mean, look, hold on. I think Dave Tippett was a really good coach at one point, and I think he was one of the better coaches in the league for a long time. And for whatever reason, his last couple of seasons in Arizona, I mean, look, the team was never great. But I think if you're, or even, I don't think the Ducks would hire Daryl Sutter, but I just think it would have to be, it would be an established type. It would not be a new school guy. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, they did interview Travis Green, I believe.
Yes.
And, you know, there are guys like Todd Nelson, who's coaching down in the AHL, who supposedly is very progressive, that are rolling around. You know, a guy like Kirk Muller, you know, who's had his shot here and there, is now back to associate coaching. I don't know. It would be interesting. But for me, this is like a super long-winded response, but I really see them going the kind of established coach route. What do you think of that? What do you think of the Dave Tippett suggestion?
I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of that. I don't know, because I feel like Carlisle was their chance to go to that established guy, and I think that's probably a big...
He's one of the bad established guys.
I think you and I make no bones about it. I don't think either of us believe that Carlisle is that great of a coach. I'd put him in the bottom 15 in the league. I think if we're looking at coaches that make a difference for the team, and I think the difference a coach can make on the actual win, loss, and percentage points for the team is pretty marginal in the grand scheme of things, but it does have an effect.
For sure.
But at the end of the day, it's the guys on the ice that are playing that are earning the points. So a team can be good in spite of its coaching. But I think Carlisle is that higher. I think that's the going back to the old school mentality and kind of going for that established guy. And I think that's probably why they went for him over going with Travis Green. Or I don't even know if they interviewed Dallas Eakins, honestly, but going with a Dallas Eakins. I think Dallas Eakins, it's a little bit of a different scenario because he is within the organization already.
Yes, this is true.
Bob Murray is able to see what he's been able to do with the goals, do with those guys, how he's developed players. I mean, you look at the pipeline that he's developed, how the players have been developing since he's been brought in. I mean, I'm just kind of thinking back to when they were the Norfolk Admirals, and I can't remember this many guys coming up and making an impact in the same way that guys are coming up from San Diego and they're just ready to get going. And part of that might be that San Diego is closer, but I think a big part of that is the development that the guys are getting down there. You look at, I mean, think about all the guys that have come up, and it's really, really impressive. And I think that he should be commended, and I hope the organization is taking note of that and keeping him in mind if they do consider a coaching change.
Yeah, but here's my thing. Here's where I agree with you that him being in the house definitely improves his, I think it improves his chances by like orders of magnitude. But that being said, wouldn't there also be a school of thought where, hey, you know, he's been so good at developing these guys, will that stop if we, you know, promote him, or will that continue? I feel like that may actually work against him in some ways to get that promotion.
Maybe. I mean, it's hard to fully say. I mean, I'm going to use an example here of the Lightning, and it's hard because GMs are going to be different. But, I mean, John Cooper was very similar. I mean, he was in Syracuse.
Syracuse, yeah.
And actually, I think he was also the coach in Norfolk before they moved to Syracuse, and they were one of the greatest AHL teams ever. And just was a great coach down there, developed guys, coached all these guys before they, like Tyler Johnson, Andre Plott, I think, all these guys that eventually made the NHL club.
Jonathan Drouin.
Yeah. I think that Jonathan Drouin was drafted after Cooper was coach already.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yes. But he did. Yeah. He I know he was in Norfolk for a little bit. So.
Syracuse.
Or no, sorry. Syracuse. Yeah. Yes.
because Cooper actually, he was brought in, and it was when Tampa was in a really big down spot, and they had fired their coach in Guy Boucher and brought in John Cooper, and I can remember this specific quote. He's like, apologies to Steve Yzerman, but I'm going to ruin your first overall pick. Essentially, the team's going to outperform where they're at right now and ruin his chance of getting a first overall pick, and they ended up getting third overall and picking Jonathan Drouin, which has now turned into Sergachev. And you look at the trajectory of that club since they fired Boucher and brought in John Cooper, and it's just been up, 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 up. Last year was a bit of a downturn, but it was injuries. And, I mean, say that, look at the Ducks, similar thing this year with injuries, very kind of similar. But I just think that's a really good example of bringing your guy in that's developed players in the minors and kind of look at what he's able to do with the NHL club. And it gets me excited thinking about the possibility of Eakins coming up, even though most likely it will never happen.
Yeah, I mean, you make a number of interesting points there. By the way, as an aside, one of my favorite games to play is just like tracking how many different cities, the trajectory of a minor league team. It's kind of fun. It's kind of crazy sometimes. You realize how many times these franchises move around, or even like swap cities or trade names or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, to your point, I mean, I do think that if the Ducks embraced, you know, a more, let's just say, more progressive coach, a guy who's gonna, you know, really supposedly, you know, bring in more structure and kind of more of a direction, I think that would transform the franchise because the talent is not all there right now because of some of the moves they've made, but the big pieces are there and, you know, there is help on the way. And it just, you really wonder how much that could do. My biggest criticism of Randy Carlyle and why, if there were a suitable replacement out there or a replacement that you would feel good about, because by the way, you know, it's going really bad for the Ducks right now in terms of the underlying numbers. And, you know, but Carlyle did just take them to a Western Conference final last season. But even when you switch coaches, it's not a guarantee of anything. You know, like I remember me being a depressed Habs fan, I guess, or I could have just said Habs fan. But, you know, I remember the day that Michel Therrien got fired and I was so happy. It was probably one of the like top 12 days of my life. And then knowing that Claude Julien was coming and how good of a coach he is. But even as good as Claude Julien is, and, you know, the Canadiens' possession game has really been top-notch since then, other issues can arise. Like, the Canadiens aren't the best team in terms of generating scoring chances or, you know, getting those grade-A chances. And the same thing happened to the Bruins in Julien's last year. So you wonder if there's a coaching effect there. So all that to say that I do think that Carlisle's performance right now could warrant a coaching change. I think that you have to be careful what you wish for because there's never a sure thing in hockey. Although I can hear a lot of people saying right now, well, anything is better than Carlisle, I guess.
Yeah. And kind of staying on the Carlisle point, our good buddy Kyle, staff writer on the site, asks in the Mixler chat, they say Randy Carlisle has changed from his previous ways of a head coach. Is he back to his old ways?
I would say so. I mean, look at it this way. So, to me, this period the Ducks have gone through, missing all their guys, supposedly all their guys, right? I mean, realistically, a couple guys, and as time has gone on, the roster is filled back out. Still missing some key guys, by the way. But you look at the way this has gone, and most coaches, at least to my understanding, would really try to make this a defense-first team, just really shut it down, really tighten it up. And it's been the complete opposite in terms of the results, in terms of the underlying numbers. And you just wonder, is this his version of shutting it down? Getting, like, we're just going to accept getting outshot every game? I mean, to me, you see what Bruce Boudreau did that last year in Anaheim where he turned them into just a defensive juggernaut. And that was a coaching job. That was not – the Ducks were not that team before that, basically, when the calendar flipped from 2015 – 2016. They were a bad possession team before that, or middle of the road. They were okay. They were like a 51, 50, yeah, like they, whatever you call it.
Team. They deserve better results than they were getting at that time. Their shooting percentage was just unsustainably low. But,
oh, yes.
Yeah.
But I'm talking maybe like the 2-3 seasons before that.
Okay. Yeah, sorry.
That was never their strong suit. And maybe we're giving too much credit to Boudreau, but I think there is a significant portion of that that was him. And for me, Randy Carlyle, obviously it's tough to do that with the talent that he had at his disposal. But at the same time, you'd think he'd find some way to minimize the damage, minimize the bleeding outside of just saying, hey, Gibby, stop everything tonight, because that's what the numbers are showing. So I don't know. I mean, to me, a good coach can elevate a team. And the fact that Carlyle seemingly didn't elevate them, or maybe he is elevating them and we're just not aware of it, I don't think that's the case, but I feel like that speaks a little bit to kind of the job he's done, or lack thereof.
Well, I think to properly answer this question, we have to really think about what changed. How did he evolve? Because I can remember last year, a lot of the talk was that, I think more so from the players and maybe some of the media, that he softened up, that he's a little bit different now than he used to be. He's not the same Carlyle as he was before.
And that was grumpy.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you could maybe look at it and say he was trusting the younger guys more. And I think you could probably look at this season and say the same thing with elevating guys like Kevin Waugh and that type of stuff. But I think if we look at system-wise, the breakout's similar to
what is the system?
Yeah, exactly. Well, there was a really, really good piece. I think it was back in maybe like 2013, 2012, somewhere around there, written on one of our sister SB Nation sites, Pension Plan Puppets. Awesome site if you don't know about it. That is the Leaf site. And they had an article up there kind of breaking down the Carlyle breakout. And it kind of isolated three different types of systems that are fairly basic and kind of anyone uses going back down to Pee Wee, and just how it was hampering the team and how it wasn't working because of how low the forwards were. It was creating chances for the defense to pinch and keep the puck in and get scoring chances against the team. And it's just, and you look at that and it's like, huh, that sounds familiar right now.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah, maybe you're right. Yeah.
And all that talk about Carlyle changing and all this stuff, it's very, I think it's just so unlikely for a guy like Carlyle, that's such kind of an old school guy, to, I would assume that he's probably in his 60s. People kind of around that age know what they know and kind of like what they like. And I just don't see him evolving that much at that point in time. I don't know if that's me kind of being a bit narrow-minded, but I think he just is what he is. And I think we bought into that with bringing him back. And I also think, I can remember staff writer Benny had brought up the fact that the thought process of Carlyle being a good defensive coach isn't a real thing. Weirdly enough, I think the Maple Leafs with him were actually a better offensive team than they were defensive. And so this whole thought process of him being good defensively is just kind of a narrative made by the media and perpetuated by people. And it's not exactly true. And I mean, look at this season, look at how much they're bleeding shot attempts against. It's so bad. I mean, like I said earlier, they're on the level of the freaking Arizona Coyotes. You can't tell me, even with the injuries this team has had, and that's what a lot of people kind of bring up, is that look at how injured they are. Look at the forwards. The centers would help. Yes, but this team with this defensive lineup should not be in the same conversation as the Arizona Coyotes in any way, shape, or form with that. And it's awful, and that's defensive structure. That's on the coach. We've said it a bunch, but it's on the coach. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, I think that part of the reputation from Randy Carlyle as a defensive guy is that he was a defenseman back in his career, and a good one at that, won a Norris Trophy.
Yeah.
Also got, like, hundreds of penalty minutes a season for a while. So, but yeah, I mean, I'll give this quick anecdote, and I don't know, like, how much stock to put in this, but I remember being at Ducks training camp this year, and I remember watching their practice, and maybe a lot of NHL teams do this, because your comment about it's the same system through Pee Wee or whatever. And I remember watching the Ducks practice, and just for like background here, I played college roller hockey, which is like not like club roller, like not varsity or anything, but still competitive, right? And like our coaches had played at decently high levels, right? So it was not like the best hockey.
You've still hashtag played the game.
Yeah, like I'm like flashing my played the game card right now, but no, like our coaches definitely played the games. Like those guys were great, and anyway, can't say enough good things about those guys. But I was watching the Ducks practice, and they were doing the exact same drills we did for as a roller hockey team. It was like just cut and paste. It was like the same practice. And I was wondering to myself, is this like normal in the NHL? Like, were we doing NHL drills, or are the Ducks behind the eight ball? Like, I didn't know where to go with that. But anyway, to your point about the Ducks system maybe not being the best, I don't know if that helps or doesn't help that idea for sure.
Yeah. So Kyle brings up another point in the Mixler chat, and anyone listening on Mixler, feel free to jump in. We're kind of just going to answer questions, I think, for the rest of this time. So if you have anything you want us to hit on, let us know. He brings up, for the common fan out there, are transactional moves made by the GM or the coach? Does Bob Murray tell Carlisle that the guy they are going to put Kosla or Waugh down to the AHL? You want to take this one, or you want me to?
Go ahead.
I mean, I think Bob Murray ends up having final say. I think Carlisle definitely can give his input on that, but at the end of the day, the GM's going to make the call on who to send down, who to bring up. And the same way with trades, he'll probably ask the coach for what he thinks, but final say is always going to end up being with the GM.
Yeah, I think it kind of, the GM is definitely the guy who decides, but I feel like there's got to be a pretty good sort of like two-way street there, working relationship. So yeah, but you know, and also every management group is different, right? So some teams, like the Maple Leafs, for example, where they have their team president, Brandon Shanahan, who's definitely a lot more involved, is kind of like, in a way, the pseudo GM. Mm-hmm. And then you have Lou Lamoriello, who is the GM, although you don't really think of him as the leader of that team. And then you also have, you know, Mike Babcock, who's the head coach, who you have to believe has a lot of say there. So yeah, kind of like every team has its different structure. I guess my guess for the Ducks would be that Murray and Carlisle are pretty tight.
Yeah, I'd see that. We also had a Twitter question that I think we missed last time that was asked to you.
Yes. So what did I – was it the Walensky-Fowler question?
No, there is – without a trade, what do you think is our best possible pairs or our best possible pairs would be, including players on the goals? Oh, yeah, it was in reference to your Fowler-Walensky comment. Sorry.
Yeah. So, well, to that question, I don't think I did answer that. You know, honestly, I'm not sure how to feel about that, because on one hand, I think Montour Fowler sounds great, but we don't know about it. But then we also know Bieksa and Beauchemin on two different pairings is also bad. But then, you know, like, there's not really a clear cut answer. I think what I would settle on, I wouldn't feel great about it, but I think Lindholm Montour makes a lot of sense to me. Manson Fowler, I kind of go back and forth on. You're still going to have Beauchemin with Bieksa, but I think that those first two pairings would be so good. I mean, like, so good, especially the first one, that I think that would work. Because otherwise, I just don't see them ever taking both those guys on the third pairing out of the lineup. So that would probably be my best shot at it. But I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think we kind of – I feel like I say this a bunch, but we have to give kind of our dream answer – and our more realistic answer. I think my dream answer would probably be something along the lines of either, probably I'd love to see Fowler, Manson, Lindholm, Montour together. I think Lindholm's just so good, and he can make up for kind of or cover for Montour if he wants to pinch up. And then maybe you go with like a Beauchemin and Walensky, something like that, as the bottom pairing. I'd prefer even to bring up Larson at this point and have Larson, Walensky, and just have Beauchemin and BX out. But I don't think Beauchemin's been that terrible this year.
Right. You know what? Sorry to cut you off, but one thing that I'm kind of thinking of is, because, you know, Fowler, BXA they've had some okay games. Like,
no,
it's really weird.
No.
Well, look at tonight.
I've just been burned so much by that pairing that it's okay. Just...
But hear me out.
We have such a big sample size showing that they're terrible together. Yeah.
Well, okay, but think about it. Manson and Beauchemin. I feel like that could be okay. So if you keep Fowler, Bieksa, but then you, I think Manson and Boschman could be okay together because Manson also kind of makes whoever's next to him better. So
yeah,
I don't know. Or you go Boschman Fowler? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean we've also seen that in the past in Boschman's first go around here.
There's no good answers, but there's like less bad answers.
Yeah,
I guess.
I think that my dream would probably be the Montour, Lindholm, Fowler, Manson, then Walensky, Boschman. Or Magna, yeah. Bojame or Larson Bojame. Some combination where Bojame is on the bottom pairing and BX is in the press box and never gets to see the ice again. I think realistically what we can probably hope for as the best is probably going to be some sort. I mean, I think realistically what we're going to get is going to be Lindholm, Manson, Fowler, BX, Bojame, and Montour.
No doubt.
I think that's
no
just what,
we've already seen it.
Yeah, I think that's going to happen. Paulette brings up a good point that the Ducks don't have much defensive D-men in their system after Manson. I mean, I can take kind of a bigger look at this. I think the idea of defensive and offensive defensemen is kind of something that isn't... It's not exactly a thing. Like, we think about guys that are defensive defensemen are guys that kind of don't put up points or any of this stuff. Yet, guys that are offensive defensemen are guys that put up points and don't do anything. And then, I don't know, kind of one, sorry, that kind of rambled a bit. But one analogy that I always kind of like to go to is I think it was going back to Dave Tippett, actually. He had a really good quote one time is that we were looking at two players and one guy was a quote unquote defensive defenseman. And
oh, yes, I remember this quote. It's
and
a good quote.
He was perceived as that because he was always in his defensive zone. And maybe he did a decent job of covering the guys in the front of the net, but he was always there and constantly defending. And you can see that by looking. And this is why I feel like looking at Corsi 4 percentage is a really good tool for defensemen because you can see if they're stuck in their D zone the whole time. Whereas they had more a guy who was more perceived as an offensive defenseman, and he had that perception because he was never in his defensive zone. So even though he may not have been as strong in his defensive zone at actually defending, he was never there because he was constantly getting the puck and putting it out of the zone. So even though he was perceived as not being great defensively, he constantly got the puck out. And at the end of the day, that's what matters when you're looking at a defenseman. A defenseman should not have to be in his own zone defending guys in front of the net, defending guys in the corner. The best defenseman is a guy like Lindholm who gets the puck, gets it out of the zone, doesn't really ever have to defend that much because he's so good at getting that puck. And I'd be pretty positive that the guy Tippett was talking about as the offensive defenseman is Keith Yandle.
Yeah.
Yandle will never be talked about as being a good defenseman or good in his own zone, good defensive defenseman. Yet, he's great. And Paulette brings up stay-at-home D-men like Manson, Lovejoy, Dupre. I actually don't think Lovejoy is really a defensive defenseman. I think that's one guy that got that you have.
Because
he's
big.
Lovejoy's not that big, but he kind of gets that.
Bigger,
Yeah, people think of him that way because he's kind of stuck in his own zone a lot.
Yeah, I think with Manson's also kind of a case study in this where, yeah, like he fights and he likes to hit people, but if you really watch him play, him and Lindholm are actually pretty similar in that they're just so good at when a guy's along the wall or down low, they just find a way to knock them off the puck. They just, Lindholm's best move is where he basically just pushes you right on your hip with his left glove. And just sends you, not flying, but you just get separated. And Manson's also really good at that. And, you know, like you were saying with shot attempts four, Manson, you know, he gets that puck back. And then he knows exactly where to go with it. He makes a smart play. He doesn't just chip it off the wall. So it's like you were saying, you know, a defenseman's best trait is basically never having to defend. And when you do, puck goes in, puck comes back out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Paulette brought up that he played well with Fowler, and I agree with that. I think both of us kind of are on the same mindset that
who played well with Fowler?
Lovejoy.
He did. Yeah,
played well with him in the past. But I think the bigger point I think we're both kind of hitting on is just because you don't have a quote unquote defensive defenseman in the lineup isn't a bad thing. Look at Tampa for instance. I don't really think their best D pairs have really defensive defensemen. I mean, no. unless you think of Hedman as being and Strawman as being defensive defensemen, but I think that they don't exactly have that description attached to them. But their kind of top D men are those two plus Sergachev. So, yeah.
I mean, a good defense, the sign of a good defenseman is not having to defend that often. And when you do, it doesn't last very long, you know? Yep. And so, like, guys like Shea Weber, you know, Shea Weber is almost kind of like the last of his kind. But the thing is, even he's not really stay at home because he's actually an okay skater and very good offensive guy. But it's more of a narrative than anything else. It's just if a guy looks big and mean and he hits people, and you know, and Shea Weber destroys people, and so does Josh Manson. But that's not really what actually makes their games effective. It's the rest of it that isn't quite as fun to watch. And that's fine. Like, I mean, I love a good defenseman who can do that stuff, but it's just, it's more, like you said, it's more of a narrative than an actual reality.
Yeah, in a similar way, we kind of talked about Carlisle has this narrative attached to him that he's a good defensive coach. It's the same thing with kind of defensemen. You don't exactly need to be a good defensive defenseman to be good defensively, if that makes sense.
Exactly. Yes, yes. All right. Anything else we want to hit on? I feel like we're kind of getting to the end here.
We've got one quick anecdote question type comment if you want me to kind of hit it
real
quick.
Go for it, go for it.
It's from Datadog. As an anecdote, I don't think the Ducks have a guy on the team who can stop the puck from exiting the zone on the boards. Correct me if I'm wrong, Datadog, but I think you're talking about in the offensive zone. He's talking about in the offensive zone, I think the guys are pretty solid. If he's talking about in terms of keeping the puck from exiting the offensive zone, he's talking about the defensive zone. In terms of forwards providing that support, that's not on the forwards to me. That's more on the structure. And I think that's kind of what we tried to talk about.
Because guys are coachable. I mean, like what you'll hear all the time from hockey players and NHL guys is like, I just want a system. I want something like, tell me what to do type of thing. And they love to just be able to follow the script and not have to freewheel it. And either you got a bunch of guys who aren't listening, or you got a bunch of guys who are doing exactly how they're told, or somewhere in between. I don't know. It's
yeah.
an interesting debate.
And one thing I would like to hit on with that also is that the boards are always used because they're safe, they're away from the goal. But if a defenseman puts the puck along the boards as a way to make his pass or clear the puck, I mean, sometimes it's a necessity and it's the best option. But you're making that forward then pull the puck off the boards, figure out where the guy is, and it's kind of adds an extra step where if you can make that tape to tape pass, you're removing that extra step and it gives you a much better chance of exiting the zone and creating scoring chances going the other way. And I think a lot of times we see the best defenseman on the team with Hampus Lindholm or Fowler when he's on his game or Manson, they're at their best when they're making those tape to tape passes. They're not having to just rim it around to get it out. And I think we see with guys like Kevin Bieksa, they struggle in terms of shot attempts because they're constantly rimming the puck around the boards. They're not picking their head up to try to make that pass. They're making the quote-unquote safe play, and it just turns the puck over.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's definitely – there's definitely a lot to be said there. All right. I feel like that's going to wrap it up for tonight.
Definitely good.
We've hit on some good topics tonight, really got deep with some of the coaching questions. I feel like that's something that – who knows, may start coming up a little bit more. But good stuff tonight as always. That's going to do it for us. If you haven't already, I say it every pod, make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, leave a review. iTunes is a great spot for us. You know, it helps the show get noticed when people leave reviews. So definitely I encourage you to do that if you're enjoying the show. SoundCloud, also a good place for getting your podcasts. We're on there. Subscribe to us if you're a frequent user. We'll pop right into your feed. Give the episode a heart if you enjoyed the show, or give us a follow, either or. And then, did I say something wrong there?
No.
I probably did. Oh, no. Go for it.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, with the reviews on iTunes, I don't know if you were going to say this.
Oh, yes, that's
but
right.
If you leave a review, add in kind of your favorite Ducks moment, who was your favorite player, or I think the best thing and kind of where you can make it personal is what moment did you become a fan? What made you a fan of this team, if you can remember, and not just a childhood a fan since your childhood like me? And we'll read it on the podcast and give you a shout out and kind of a good way for everyone to share their own little story.
Okay. So, or if you're like me and you're not a Ducks fan, you can leave maybe a little, like, what you think the Ducks should fix or who they should trade for. A little something like that if you're not looking to throw out a memory, because that stuff kind of goes over my head. But still, I like the idea. But yeah, feel free to say anything you want in there. But we'll definitely, if you've got an idea for the Ducks, an idea that you want discussed and you put it on there, we'll definitely talk about it. We'll shout you out. And like Jake said, if you leave a little fun anecdote, fun memory as a Ducks fan, then we'll certainly get into that, because that's kind of what fuels the show, right, is the fans of this team. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Follow us on those two sites, SoundCloud and iTunes. As always, AnaheimCalling.com, at Anaheim Calling on Twitter, who hosts this show. They, I mean, we don't really talk about it much, but we use the Anaheim Calling SB Nation platform, and it does a lot of good for us. And, you know, if we were independent on our own, we'd have to actually, it'd be a lot harder to get the fans that we have. So,
yep.
Big shout out to SB Nation and Anaheim Calling.
Thanks to CJ for retweeting us from the main Anaheim Calling account.
Yes, thank you so much. And, you know, for letting us use your bandwidth or whatever to have our podcast files on here. And then thank you, Jake, for coming on, at RainierGames91 on Twitter. And then myself, at Felix_Sicard, tweeting out podcasts and articles. So, guys, that'll do it for today. We will catch you at the next pod. I believe it is Thursday night against the New York Islanders. So another tough matchup for the Ducks. I think they've run out of the, well, maybe they can win this one type games for the week, because after that it's Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh on Saturday to round out the road trip show. So a lot of good stuff coming your way. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.